My name is Mike Diedrich, and I'm a host of Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92, Seattle. In recorded, actually, this is recorded on KODX 96.9 FM, and it's broadcast from there. It's a low-powered radio station. But the good thing about, thanks to the internet, this is a permanent electronic record of the conversation we're just about to have. So, Mike Diedrich, and I'll let my guest, or my other half of the program, really, Joe Gondar, to introduce himself.
My name is Joe Gondar, and I met Mike just a couple of weeks ago. I think I've run into you a few times at Veterans for Peace things
Yeah.
in the past, but we didn't ever really talked or found out that we had same MOS. I assume you're 96
Yeah.
Charlie.
96, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I was I went to into the Army. I joined, I guess you'd say, under duress. I enlisted, so I technically I was a volunteer, but I would have never enlisted if the draft wasn't there. Perhaps if it was, I went in and finished college in September or in June of '68, and at that time, more university deferment or postgraduate deferments were pretty much unavailable. And so anyway, I joined to basically stay out of the bits of the army that had to do with being in the infantry or in combat arms. Pure cowardice. I was against the war back then, but didn't seriously consider doing something like going to Canada, or it would have been something noble, like say, hell no, I don't go, and go to prison or something like that. I took the easy way out. I w wasn't the army itself wasn't ever anything I was afraid of in terms of the regiment. There are some movies that show the life of enlisted man to be particularly grueling, but I grew up with reading Beetle Bailey comic strip every day, and I figured that the army would be a little bit like Camp Swampy and Sergeant Snorkel and things like that. And in fact, I think I was pretty much right. The army was no big deal in terms of polishing your shoes and keeping your brass polished and getting a haircut and acting sort of respectful to authority. It was just that, the bits that had to do with, killing and dying that I wanted to avoid doing. And I signed up for language school. I knew probably it would be Vietnamese, although there was a chance I went in with a friend of mine, and he after going through an interrogation school, he got into Russian language school in Monterey, and I was shipped off to Vietnamese, which I thought would be okay, since I thought that it would be a year-long course, and in a year the war might be over. But in fact, it was just 12 weeks and of training, of language training, in Washington, D.C. Fort Myer is where we were billeted, in Washington, D.C., or across the river from Washington, D.C. And we had training with regular standard DLI, Defense Language Institute materials, by a private contractor in Arlington. So that's, and then I got my, had my orders to my pocket, in my pocket. Many of my classmates went to, had orders for years. I think they had the 525th MI company or something like that. I had my orders were for 90th Replacement Battalion, which meant you just hang out in Benoit, or Long Benoit perhaps, for a couple of days, and then you were given further orders. In my case, it was the 199th Light Infantry Brigade, and the had there was an MI detachment, 179th MI detachment, and they had the complement of OB analysts and image interpreters and interrogators of prisoners of war. And the interrogators were divided up, two person teams plus an interpreter, a Vietnamese army sergeant, into each of the four battalions. So I spent time in usually mostly the second battalion, third infantry, the second of the third of the 199th Light Infantry Brigade. So, and that was, we were about 50 miles northeast of Saigon most of the time. That's in rubber plantation country. And then I was, there was the 5th of the 12th that the Cambodian invasion was detached to the first cab, and they went to Cambodia. And the interrogator there was short, and they needed somebody. And I thought it would have been a, kind of a grand thing to do. So I volunteered to go to Cambodia. Didn't have to. And when I was there, I thought, I'm going to feel really stupid if I get killed in this place. But it was, so it was, we were in for a couple of weeks. I was detached to the 5th of the 12th. I didn't talk to that many prisoners, actually. I was the first person they talked to, a prisoner. So, and usually they were wounded, and I would talk to them for an hour or something like that, and they would be sent off to a hospital and to the rear, and then they ultimately probably talk to you, Mike, or some
Yeah.
one of your cohorts. One of the things we did, so other duties were like going through rucksacks of dead people and getting military information, translating documents off dead people, the people that we killed. And I went on a lot of MEDCAPs, these civic action programs, winning hearts and minds of the people. Went out with the battalion surgeon and with the medics, and they would, for a couple of hours there or there, and I really didn't have, wasn't given really a lot of instructions, but we would walk around. I would walk around with my interpreter, and we would talk to the village chief, or the, if a priest, perhaps, if it was a Catholic village, and ask about VC activity in the area. And sometimes I had a report that was worth writing, and I don't think it was ever worth reading, but I came back and did that. And so that was my year in Vietnam. I never really felt in danger. Sometimes we got, a few, I was ever in a firefight, for example. Never spent, we would go around to these jump talks, and you'd have to, it would be kind of dirty work. You'd have to fill sandbags and get yourself undercover
Yeah.
overnight and things like that. But
So,
never really in danger.
what year were you there? What
I
month?
was there. I went over into the military in September of 68, and then
Okay.
with training, I went over August 1st, 69.
Okay.
So
Yeah.
69 to 70. When were you over, Mike?
I spent almost all of the 1970 or 68 in Vietnam.
68. So you were there during Tet Offensive. Yeah. It was a lot quieter when I was there in 69, 70.
Well, it's sort of the same rule. I'll give my background here, and then we're going to pick up back to Vietnam. But I was drafted, and the reason I was drafted is I lost my student deferment. The reason I lost my student deferment was I flunked out of the University of Washington twice, so they snatched me up, and I. On the draft, and I went down to go down to see a recruiter in a sort of naive assumption that maybe I could get a better job and stay out of the war. And some of that was sort of true. I didn't end up in the infantry, but I did go out with the infantry a few times. So I was enlisted to as intelligence analyst, which was a kind of
So
a
was that a 3-year hitch or two?
A three-year
You were
hitch, yeah.
three-year hitch, yeah.
As an intelligence analyst, so I went from there to after basic Fort L big in Louisiana,
Fort Polk.
Fort Polk, god awful place. The weather is just god awful, with the heat and the humidity and the bugs. But anyway, That was a good prerequisite for Vietnam. Anyway, it went to Holabird, and that was sort of prerequisite, hot and humid too. But Holabird was a MI school right in the
Yeah.
heart of Baltimore, local. So the intelligence analyst course was like several months long, and I oh, two-thirds of the way through there, I was on a got I had a really bad cold, and they stuck me on this detail unloading of freezers, and a couple of days later I came down with a really my lungs were freezing, and it turned out to be lingering pneumonia, and so they sent me to the hospital for oh 3 4 days and pumped me full of antibiotics, and I was okay, just fine. So I went back to my unit, and the first sergeant says, "You've been gone too long," says, "We're going to have to recycle you to the next class." So I mean, oh fuck, I was in there for 36 months. It was all the same to me. But then the class that I was in, we were in a big barracks, big open barracks there, and they were got their orders, and they were whooping it up in excitement, and almost all of the people that I my class that I was originally in went to Europe. Almost all. A few went to Korea, that sort of thing. When we got our orders,
And these are OB analysts, the
no,
classes.
these were well, intelligence analysts.
Yeah.
Well, OB too.
Well, yeah,
So
right.
I think many of them actually ended up to the short interrogator course, which I ended up doing too. But so I went through, finished the intelligence analyst, and said, "Well, you're going to make you an interrogator." So I had like a what was a 4 or 4 week, if that, course on being an interrogator. And I can't remember if the Geneva Convention ever fucking
I don't remember it ever
accepted.
being mentioned.
I heard it in basic, and then but we all knew what the Geneva Convention was, and then you
Yeah,
received.
you get it from movies as much as anything. It's in the zeitgeist. Yeah.
Anyway, I after I finished the analyst course and then interrogator's course, they sent me to language school in Biggsville, Fort Bliss, Texas, West Texas. God, the fact that they went and killed all those Apaches and Comanches for that fucking West Texas is godforsaken part of the world. But but coming from the green Northwest, it was a shock. So
How long was the class? How many
it
weeks?
was like 3 months or so. It was quite
Oh, so
fairly.
it was like mine. I had 12 weeks.
Yeah, it was actually a little longer than that. So shipping off to Vietnam when I finally got my orders, we all knew we were going to go to Vietnam, of course, and then let's see. Probably I would have if I wouldn't. I should have probably studied more diligently than I did. Although, by the time I got to Vietnam with my sort of rudimentary knowledge of Vietnamese, I picked it up because I picked it up enough so that I was able to conduct interrogations by myself. And
Oh.
you're only you need 500 words. My company or team was an order of battle, and basically you just ask them what their name was, where they were born, that sort of thing. Did they infiltrate or
Yeah.
something like that? And then what was the unit? How big was it? Where was it? What kind of weapons you had? The basics, real nuts and bolts of intelligence. And I tell people this, this counterintelligence bullshit is wasn't. You want to know where they are, how big their unit is, how kind of weapons is, and then you pass write a report on that, pass it up to the analyst, and they pass. I was in a MACV unit under directly under, and they pass it out to the combat units, to the divisions or something, and they go out and try and find these people and kill them. So that was the whole thing, how successful. Was they were the NLF, as in the known in the South, were very difficult to actually catch out and get into full scale combat. That was not true in Tet Offensive, where they sort of ran themselves on their swords and into American and Arvin firepower and lost an awful lot of people. So anyway, I was there sent to Company A, 519th MI Battalion, 525th MI. And we spent most of our time, when not in the field, at the Combined Military Interrogation Center, which is just off from Plantation Road, off from the racetrack, which is the site of a lot of fighting during Tet and May 1968. So that's where I was during the Tet Offensive, May Offensive, and the my experience there during the two offensive. I mean, people said the Tet Offensive, think of the Tet Offensive only lasting for a few weeks after, January, but it lasted there for almost 6 months on and off. There were infiltrated units in the city, and so it was January through June. And when we were there, we started trying to keep our head down, and there were periodic firefights and bombings, and they brought in cav from the field, from the 25th Infantry and 4th Division Infantry, and they had they not come in, it might have been a little dicier for us where we were, because they had some just they brought in their armored personnel carriers and ran smack into these NLF units, and they had big ass firefights, particularly along Plantation Road and the racetrack. I mean, it was like it was, it was like the fucking noise was just unbelievable. And so for me, the probably the defining moments of it was during the May Offensive, May 7th. And there we had a village right next to us, sort of insider wire. It was like a refugee village. It's like, people had been displaced by the war. And so the village was a collection of shacks and, tin roofs. And there were some NLF infiltrators there. I saw one or two, and the Arvin and the U.S. brought in those being a single prop fire of planes dropping bombs. God, what were they? Gunships, jets with dropping napalm and white phosphorus, Willie Peter. And then strafing it, and this village was literally blown and sh blown away and burned up. Napalm. I mean, we were close enough to it. We were sitting on top of one of our buildings, and it was napalm was hot enough so it almost burned your face. And then they dropped 250-pound and then 500-pound bombs. I mean, the 250-pound, we were only 40, 50 yards away, and the concussion from the 250 pounds was just amazing. And then they dropped the 500 pounds, and fuck, it's it hits you like somebody slapped you in the face. We were lucky enough so we were on that top of the thing, but the blast, it went up and then didn't go sideways enough, but the blast went up and then down, and so we were all on our face on top of that building, and these big chunks of shrapnel landed on us. They didn't come down sideways, but they were heavy enough, stinky, heavy, dangerous. So about that time, our first sergeant says, "Get the fuck off the roof," and we got off there. There were a few people who got shot from stray rounds, that sort of thing. But the thing, what happened was that all those people, they were all Vietnamese civilians, got just toasted. They'd come to us because we knew a lot of them. We'd drink in their little canteens, and they ran little bars and whorehouses. So we knew a lot of these people, and to the extent that when we walked down the road to go to our company of 519th or to the CIMIC, they'd say, "Oh, where are you going, Didao?" And I'd say, "Dilam, going to work." And they sometimes would give us bar girls would be lascivious, lewd remarks to us, sort of saying it was sort of they were it was you know it sort of was like a community in a way. But anyway, it was shocking to us to see all those dead people. Met some of them who we knew. One of them came to us was a few stragglers who had been shot and wounded. One was a young girl who took a god awful long time to die. She should have died. So we were sitting there locked up in our barracks because we couldn't get around. There's too much stray fighting going on, and had to listen to her die. That's probably one of the best worst things that it's certainly the most defining thing of the war. Although, I saw go out in the field and you'd see fire bases and they use artillery to, HI, they call it HI fire, harassment and interdiction fire, and they'd fire to coordinates. some of them were provided by me in interrogation, other interrogators, is that there's BC activity there, and a lot of it was just useless expended ammunition, but sometimes they just ended up killing people or water buffaloes or chickens. And anyway, so I go
Yeah,
on appeal
I put
too.
plenty of reports, and they wanted a 6-digit cordis, Yankee Tango 846-929. And in fact, the funny thing is, I'd go to these villages and I would talk to the village chief, and they'd say, well, yeah, there was somebody or another. There was a couple of VC in the area, and they. One person was the tax collector, and the other person was the kind of the shadow mayor of this area of the VC. Anyway, they would be in this area, and the rubber plantations, and they would slip away, and I'd be talking to them, and we'd be pointing. And the whole year I was in Vietnam, sometimes you're walking around, and you realize that what you thought is north is actually south, that you're disoriented for a second, and you kind of have, kind of twist your head around and do a kind of mental gymnastic and say, okay, that's south, and then everything's okay. The whole year I was in Vietnam, the sun rose in the west for me and set in the east. I would go outside the door, and I couldn't get my internal gyroscope, properly fit. And I'd go to these villages, and I'd have this green map. There's this village and a sea of green around it. The sky is blah blah blah, and there was a squad, five people that were in this area and that area. And I'm listening to them, but I'm not going to say, where the hell is that on the map? You're not going to do that. And so I would pick a spot, I would do this report, and there'd be a, I'd find, put a 6-digit coordinate of a hunk of the jungle. And so I imagine that I destroyed some vegetation that deserved to live.
That's funny because I had similar problems about and I look at a map where the military maps that they provide us with there's coordinates in it, and so these prisoners said, he said, no, right here. And I said, oh,
So he was able to read the
thank you
map.
very much.
Yeah, I think I was told you're not supposed to have them, you're supposed to go and backtrack or some kind of bullshit, And anyway, yeah, I had, you think that the military would have given me a damn compass, and all you get one from the Cracker Jack box, and it was for free. But I didn't have a compass when I went to these villages. I didn't know north from south, but and I would, write these reports. It's pretty useless. My intelligence, the intelligence I passed on.
I did a lot of interrogations there, a lot of them, dozens and dozens. A lot of them were what they called KBs or knowledgeability briefs, which are just brief sort of intro, sort of, to what were you doing, and basically useful to for the analyst to say, well, does this guy know anything worth talking to him again, whether or not to. But I did a lot of those interrogations at CMYK, and when I went out to the field, which I like to go out in the field because I get away from our chicken shit guard duty and chicken shit just bullshit stuff that sort of stateside bullshit about haircuts and crap like that. So I go out to field with the MACV units, Arvin units. I was out to the 1st Infantry out with there and Xeon Lyke out in the rubber plantations, which was interesting. And up in the highlands, Bun Mictut and Dalat. And
Oh, up there too.
it was nice to go up there because it was cool up there, and all the Vietnamese,
Yeah.
you see them out there, and they're bundled up, and I said, God, finally it's below 80 degrees. This is just
Yeah.
right,
Yeah.
So I got around a little bit, which was nice to see the country and to get away from my unit. And it was up at Dalat that I was running. I was up there with a lifer, this E7 sergeant first class. We were up there together, and we went by this Arvin's in a hooch there, and they had his prisoner on the floor. He was wounded in a stretcher, and he was preparing to wire him up, light him up, as they said, with a field cell phone. And the sergeant with me says, "We don't want to look at this. This is not legal. That's the Geneva Convention." So we
Yeah,
walked
just.
away from it. I was able to do that a few times. The Arvin that I knew were around sometimes, their default sort of process was torture them first and then ask them questions, almost like this. We were reasonably professionally trained as interrogators from Holabird, and so we knew what the score was as far as any of the convention. UCMJ is says you're not supposed to beat people up or torture them, and for the most part we did. Some Americans didn't. They wouldn't think twice about smacking somebody or using a rifle. I was wondering, did you ever run across a guy by the name of Charlie Rogers?
No.
No.
Was he in 199th?
No, he was mostly with our unit, Company
Oh.
519th. But he
No,
got
I never met
around. He
anybody who.
was one of those older time who had been there for a couple of years. He'd married a Vietnamese woman,
No.
and he and Sergeant Mayer had been out in the field, and he had a reputation for
Being rough.
rough treatment. He was sort of a scrawny, little nervous twit. In fact, I told him once, I don't know, I might have been drinking at the time, and I told him, "Charlie," I says, "you touch any of my fucking prisoners, I'm going to shoot you." And I had a 45 in my hand at the time. He said, "Well, okay." I know, wouldn't have done it, but
So, I'm interested. I know you're against the war now. You're probably against all wars. What was your feelings about wars in general, and this war that we're talking about in particular, like before you were drafted, or would have been drafted, enlisted in Vietnam and out of Vietnam? Was it pretty much consistent with what you feel about war now?
Well, no, I mean, I got a good ground into my face what war really was, really up close and personal, particularly listening, watching people die. So that's that experience, and then a sort of an academic experience, which I was a history major in college, and even in high school I read history and was familiar with sort of what war was, and how you got into wars and that sort of thing, sort of the political military history. And I'd read quite a bit of it, but I'd also read Red Badge of Courage. I don't know if you've ever read that book, but it's about a kid
Sure.
who is
Yeah, enamored by the idea of
yeah,
it.
and also the First World War stuff,
Like what? All Quiet in Western
All Quiet
Front.
in America, a moving actually. So, but it doesn't really, and the war, I didn't like the military, didn't like it at all. I did my job. I was a good at my job. I was confident, and but the way the military did, the way that they used firepower, which was stupid, it was and blowing up these villages or shooting up villages was counterproductive. And as far as the war went, I didn't, I just was sort of disgusted and disheartened about what I saw. But I really came back and sort of processed it a little differently. I says, "Well, fuck! What a fucking mess it was, and all these people that died." So there was a little difference between an academic
Yeah. Yeah, when you're actually there and you're doing a job, like you're interrogating people, and it sounds like there was plenty of things to do during the day, or if I was going in different villages and writing reports, yeah, I did a good job, and
Yeah.
I didn't fuck around with people, and I wasn't nasty to Vietnamese. I didn't throw candy at kids and watch them
Yeah.
scramble or that sort of shit, but yeah, but then afterwards there is a deprogramming that you have on your own time afterwards, and
Yeah.
you're processing this stuff, and you of the war. Yeah, it's
So
funny, I never really thought about the war much at all for 30, 40 years, and
no.
hardly said anything to anybody about it, and something clicked about 10, 12 years ago, And I started writing some things down for some reason or another. I felt like, people say, oh, my father never talked about the war. Well, maybe he just died too soon. That if he waited until he was 70 or 65, that he might have gotten a chance to go to, but that this dad at age 40 or 50 or 55, I didn't say anything. If I died at 60, people would say, well, Joe never said anything about the war, never told any war stories. And now I'm kind of writing them down,
That's great. Well, when I got out in late 68, of course, the anti-war activity in this country was just full-fledged
Do you have
from
time to do after you came out? Did you have more time to do? Were
time to
you
no
ETS
no
right there?
no I had enlisted for 36 months, but when I was I was through with my tour there, my year's tour, and I had 4 months left to go on my
That's
ETS.
all. Also, you had a lot. You did.
So no, they came to, I was sitting here at my desk filling out the extension, 4 months extension to stay in Vietnam so I wouldn't go back to the fucked up states. And the battalion clerk came over and said, "Dietrich," he says, "you want to go home?" I said, "Well, what the fuck are you talking about?" "Yeah." And he said they were doing this, had this program where they were dropping people in 6 months
Up
or
to
less.
5 months, I think.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons was they didn't want to put up with fucking all these Vietnam veterans with bad attitudes. So they just get out of the service. So I took a 4 month drop, and God, he showed up, and then three days later I was in a plane out of Benoit.
Yeah, I had a year to go after. So I went to Vietnam. I had been in the military like 10 months. With the training, 12 weeks of language school and maybe 8 weeks of interrogation school and basic training, and then a leave. And then after a year in Vietnam, I still had a year to go. So they sent me to Fort Halibut, USAINT's intelligence school, and I was a teacher there
Oh,
for the
really?
final year. So what it was I played a prisoner, and I would and people would do these dummy, I'd have a part to play, and I would, and I'd look at this supposed person, and with military information, and it was kind of interesting, in the sense that I would there wouldn't be a second, third person in the room usually. I mean, when there was like a test or something, there was to grade this person, but ordinarily the person would interrogate me, and I'd have to keep in my head what this kid was doing right or wrong, and then debrief him afterwards. And from that, every time I've had a job interview the rest of my life, I'm back into this setting of being, and I'm analyzing this guy's questioning technique of me.
Well,
I had a year to go after Vietnam.
the people who did our interrogation training, if you want to call it, many of them were, or a whole bunch of them were, DPs, the displaced people from World War II, Czechs and Germans
Estonians, and I knew these
and
guys too.
they were a very bunch, and they were sort of a little crazy too.
Little, I agree. Yeah,
They
the
and
ones that I
I mean,
knew.
I was up at a tavern where two of them, these guys are like E6s or so, E7s, and they're drunk, and they got into a fight with each other, probably about
Ethnicity.
Germany, Germans, and what the Germans did. So I grabbed it, held one guy, and sort of broke it up. And then he sobered up, and the next day he said he thanked me. But I mean, they were a hard drinking sort of
Yeah, I knew
bunch.
some of those guys too. Well, it seems such, when we were in late 60s, World War II was so much a long time ago, but in fact, it was only 23 years or something since the end of the war. And now at this, I'm 79 years old, and 23 years ago was, I mean, it's still the 21st century. I mean, it seems like yesterday. And these World War II veterans were around, and especially these guys that not only were World War II veterans, but they are, like you say, they are DPs. These guys, I wondered, if, what their history was, to tell you the truth. That these guys that were from Eastern Europe, and they were they were recruited by the American army because they were fluent in Russian and Estonian. And
Yeah.
I mean, you know the history of the accomplices of the Gestapo and the Wehrmacht, the German army that went through Eastern Europe, and they had plenty of local
Oh
followers.
yeah.
So everyone, there are a couple of guys, and I thought, geez, I wonder if he's got this guy has blood on his hands from World War II.
They one of the things that they did, I mean, the training I thought was kind of, even at the time, was sort of ridiculous. They do, one of the guys would take a book, of course we were sort of not paying attention, he'd slam it down on the desk, oh, wake us up, to wake, this was sort of supposed to be to intimidate a prisoner or something, I don't know. But I mean the language school that we went to, there were courses that some of the text was buying a suit in Saigon, that sort of thing. And we did get into actually the military terminology, so that who, what, when, where. But the interrogation training I had was wasn't methodical. What I learned as an order of battle interrogator says you had to be methodical. He says, stick to your outline, what you want to know,
And
and
once
write
you're
up a.
there for a bit, you get to know the order of battle of the NVA army. If I was captured, I wouldn't have been able to tell them what the order of battle was of the 199th Light Infantry Brigade, but I could tell them what the 274th VC Regiment was.
And they,
And the personalities, you'd know these names, from the
So yeah, and I talked to people who had infiltrated down the trail, and their stories were all, I talked to a lot of them were very young. I
the
talked to
prisoners.
maybe 50 or 60 prisoners at least during the year, maybe more, maybe 100. And wrote up, I wrote, I mean, actually, they've got a national archives. They've got these military interrogation reports from Company A 519 and other units from the CIA and what have you. They're sitting in College Park, Maryland, the National Archives.
Really?
I went back there, and actually, well, the reason I found this out was that when I went back to Vietnam in 2013, I met this guy by accident in front of the Bưu Diem, the old French post office there in Saigon. And I told, so there's this sort of the cowboy about, what I knew. We had this fractured conversation, English, French, and Vietnamese. And then I said, okay, kind of interesting. And I was leaving the area, the square. He said, wait a minute, there's another guy who speaks Vietnamese. And he waved me over, and it turned out that the guy was named by the name of Michael Abadi, who was actually living in Vietnam, had a Vietnamese wife, spoke Vietnamese fluently. He started to teach, speak to me in Vietnamese. I said, wait a minute, wait a minute. My Vietnamese is rusty. And I told him what I was looking for. I'd actually had talked to one of the people who attacked the American embassy, a guy by the name of Ba Den. I said, on the sort of wild possibility that maybe he might still be alive. So I was just fiddling around, fooling around, and then I told him this, my name and what was, and so he emailed me. I gave him my email. So back at the hotel, I got an email from this guy, and it said, "Look at this," and it was a report from a colonel or a lieutenant colonel, maybe major, in the army, who was doing a field report or writing a per for his master's thesis, and as when his bibliography was an interrogation report from me, written by a specialist for E4, Michael Diedrich, on this guy that he's talking about, who was one of the survivors of the Tet Offensive, Ba Den. I said, well, fuck, how did that happen? That's really, it was a really a bizarre existential moment. It says, and it turned out that's what happened, is that all these reports, they were declassified in 2000 or so. So they're sitting, my report and others sitting in there in the archives, the National Archives.
I don't remember ever putting my name on a report. You put your
Really?
names on. You put name on.
Oh yeah, I mean, the forms we had were,
Oh, it was a
various
form.
report were provided by specialist, Diedrich,
Oh. No, the when I talked in any kind of report that I put out, if it was, a Chu Hoi or North Vietnam or prisoner of war or one of these from a winning hearts and minds kind of trip to a village, or the document, translation report, it was I'd be I remember it was I had this manual typewriter. It was all caps typewriter. And I would type onto blue mimeograph stencils, and there, but it wasn't the form, so it didn't have preformed or anything. And I don't know what the title was, interrogation report, and you would just put the facts out. And I remember, typing this out, what pain in the ass when you make a correction, you have to go and paint this. I don't know if you, so then they would. I would, if I was in a fire support base, and I'd stick it in one of those envelopes that had, the holes in it, routing slip, and I'd put write confidential on the outside. That was to let, and then it would just be sent to the next level up, and they would crank out. I mean, I think it was literally by hand these mimeograph things, 100 copies, and it would be sent, to, up the chain of command. And that was it, but I don't remember. I'm sure I never put my name on a document, but I didn't have a pre-printed form. Sounds like you had your it
Yeah,
was more formalized by the time it got to you.
we had CMIC forms, Combat Military Interrogation Reports, and they'd assign a number to the prisoner so that stayed with the prisoner through any interrogation that he
Oh,
had.
really?
So, God, I'll show you some of these. Got a couple of them. Actually, I was gonna show you Phil. I subsequently went back to Vietnam and through a stroke of luck, really a karmic sort of thing, ended up meeting and interviewing eight former NLF soldiers and
Yeah, you told
wrote a
right.
book
That's
about it.
pretty. And these are Viet Cong. They're not NVA.
No, these are all Southerners, NLF, three women, a couple of senior old boys from the old days, and then some regular, but most of us, they were actually, some of them were what they call Viet Dong, which is sort of like a special ranger group where they were responsible for some of the more serious attacks, at least in Saigon and elsewhere. So that was one of the things with the Vietnamese generally, particularly this Viet Dong, is that they didn't know a lot because they were compartmentalized, they're in their little squad or even smaller units, and they know that they might know their platoon chief, platoon leader, but not maybe not, And since some of them were from other areas than for where they were caught, they didn't know where the hell they were.
And in terms of order of battle information that they had, they were willing to give me, it seems. I've never found reluctance for them to tell me who their commander was, or all this shit, I mean, I think that there might have been reluctance to say where they were, but even if they knew where they were, it's the jungle. I mean, I'm talking to this person in a fire support base, and they're picked up 15 clicks away, and I don't, and I know where he was picked up, but he was walking a day. You don't know if he was walking north or south, and I told you already, I couldn't tell from north from south.
Well,
So,
the most common thing I respond I heard was Hong Biet, I don't know, and then where they were is Al Tran Ruong in the jungle. It's real specific.
And often they were, I mean, when I got them, it was, minutes or an hour after they were picked up, and I mean, for example, there was one guy that was picked up, and it was after a B-52, one of these arc lights, and he was kind of wandering around after this when the Americans moved in, and blood is coming out of his ears. And he couldn't give me his name. I mean, there was almost, I've never seen anybody as incoherent as this guy. I mean, he was literally shell-shocked. And I would be too if
Yeah,
be
I'd
52.
heard that more than once from prisoners saying that that's one of the things they feared most, because the bomb, they were bombing at 30,000 feet, so you wouldn't know it until it started hitting, you know, and they carpet bombed, and so it was like, where do you go?
And I remember one of the things we were told always was that one of the piece of information we're supposed to ask was before, I mean, the I guess through other intelligence, they found that sometimes people living in this area or their base camps or in the jungle, and they would hurriedly pick up and leave and walk, as fast as they could in another direction, and then bombs would fall in that area. And if they had ever, had this kind of information, because supposedly they, these jets took off from Guam, and the pilots didn't even know where they were dropping their bombs yet. And how did the North Vietnamese know where get that information? I don't know if that was true or false or whatever, but that was something we're supposed to find out. But yeah, the people were, you saw that they were, I mean, awfully young sometimes, these, especially the North Vietnamese, these kids that were drafted,
They were
they
like
walked
18,
down.
17, 18-year-old kids.
17 or 18, but they looked 15 or 14. You know how a lot of these Vietnamese kids are. There was one kid that was on a stretcher, and he came off a helicopter, and I had this mustache, and I'm 6 feet tall, and I leaning over him, and the interpreter is on the other side, and this kid says in Vietnamese, of course, and he said, "I thought the Russians were on our side." The people around us heard what this kid said, these other Americans. So from that time, they started calling me Stalin. It was a kind of a funny nickname for, a couple of weeks. But luckily, how army jokes kind of, luckily sort of peter out into nothing, that after a while they stopped calling me Joe Stalin from that particular
Or
moment.
also the humor tended to be kind of dark and black.
It
I mean,
was.
one somebody at our unit had clipped out a skiing from a skiing a magazine that had a skiing on it, and it said "hit the slopes" on it. And they put the and slopes was a derogatory term we called the Vietnamese.
But
So yeah.
this was the, I mean, I mean, thinking back, and you knew the history of I read the newspapers before I went in, and I was against the war, and like I say, I was, it's just cowardice got me to the recruiting station, and I had this feeling. And but then when you're in the military itself, and something happens that you realize that you're with a whole bunch of people that have the same negative feeling, about the war, and you're in this atmosphere, and then you have this humor in the war itself, and that carries you through, over this thing that and is now I, and especially in the unit that we are, that everybody had to score high enough on the IQ test, the army, and we're mostly our college graduates or dropouts or something like that. When I remember the moment for me when I realized that, I'm not the only person that feels about this war like I do. After basic training, I was sent to Fort Holabird for intelligence school, but they didn't have enough room there in the place. It was so busy, so they sent us to Fort Meade, Maryland, where that is, halfway between Baltimore and DC. And they had a kind of pop-up interrogation school. So we did the interrogation training at Fort Meade. And then so it was like the first week of school, and we had classes or something, and then we're waiting for the chow line, waiting for 5 o'clock, and we're hanging around. Half of us are horizontal on the bunks and playing cards or whatever. We listen to the radio, and the radio is on, and it said, and the top of the news would said something like that a unit some Viet Cong unit was encountered by an American unit in, it was south of Saigon somewhere, by units of the 199th Light Infantry Brigade. It's
Yeah,
the
oh
first
yeah.
time I ever heard that. And a machine gun nest and was destroyed along with two Viet Cong fighters by a fire from the battleship New Jersey.
Yeah,
And we that was on, and everybody thought that was the most ridiculous, the crazy. Everybody just broke out into laughing. I mean, there really is something ludicrous, that the battleship New Jersey's out there shooting what,
Yeah.
7-inch guns or whatever, 10-inch guns,
Sixteen inch. Sixteen inch.
16-inch guns, yeah, and they're plopping it onto this little machine gun nest, it's got two people there,
Yeah.
and this is something to brag about. So everybody in this floor just thought this was just a hoot, and I thought, well, and I thought to myself, well, I'm with a bunch of people that are going to, I'll be able to survive mentally
Yeah.
through this thing. And in Vietnam too, you get to, and you read books, and you're able, and you do your job. The job itself is actually pretty damn interesting. I mean, talking to people and writing
Yeah.
reports, and for with me going around to villages and talking to people, I mean, if you take away the proposition that I'm fighting in a war that's immoral, illegal, and unwinnable, it's kind of an interesting thing I'm doing. And the process of doing these things, and the pride you get from doing something okay and doing a good
Yeah.
job, kind of makes you skip over the bits about being in a, immoral war.
Well, I think a lot of the people in my company, anyway, who are right there in Plantation Road and the Tet Offensive, May Offensive, we got a real dose of what the war looked like, especially for receiving end, the civilians and,
Yeah, especially you say this little village
yeah.
that you got to know the people.
Yeah, I mean they poured. They had gunships, F-105s. They're dropping 250, 500-pound bombs, napalm, white phosphorus. And it was just a village with tin roofs and flats. And all that shit just went right through it. So
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the other thing was MACV had this sort of a daily log for the
Yeah.
whole country. You could look at it and say, what happened when they sort of, and there were hundreds of people killed there, we estimated. And there were major firefights up and down there thing. And look, I said, looked at the MACV situation report, the sit reps, and not to mention, one of the guys who was an interrogator with me, he'd said that it was his scuttlebutt that the Company A, which was, we were in a concrete building and we all had M14s, But still, they could have put some satchel charges in there and come in and shot us up if they wanted to. This guy said, well, we were supposed to be expendable according to MACV. That may or may not be true, but I mean, what we saw and did there was not re part of the r record, And it kind of affected us all. We tried to get some money together for the survivors and that sort of thing, but Mark, it's kind of interesting you mentioned the there's guns from the battleship. I was sitting in a firebase with the 1st Infantry Division, called night defensive positions. This fireplace firebase, and at night I was talking to this. Well, when I got there, the Spec 4 was sitting on standing. He says, "You should have been here 2 weeks ago." He says, "We killed 20 of them inside the wire." I said, "Jesus, I'm sorry I missed that." But at night, the guy pointed up to the sky. He says, "Yeah." He says, "Those big guns. You could actually see the rounds. They're so fucking big." And I actually did see it. So it looked like a small,
Yeah.
a big, big round, going across the sky like I confused it with a satellite. It's so goddamn big.
Yeah, by the time I got, well, the 199th, when you were there, the 199th was south of Saigon, and in, I mean, not into the deep delta where the 9th Infantry was, but some province south east of Saigon. And then they moved to this rubber plantation area northeast of Saigon,
Yeah.
when I was there. And then the battleship New Jersey was finally withdrawn. Even the idiots that ran the war probably figured out that finally that this was really a little that was not cost effective or something, for this World War II battleship to be out there.
Well, when I was at Lycae, I think it was Zeon or Lycae, they had a
Like, hey, is
battery.
where what the first was, first
Yeah, First
infantry.
Infantry, and they had a battery of these 8 or 9 inch guns, and they may have been naval guns, but we were downrange from them, and I mean, you couldn't sleep. They fired them off all night long, and just the concussion of it was
Yeah,
enormous.
I go at fire support bases were not is not I mean, with that when the artillery and they were going all the damn time
Yeah.
at these jump talks and fire support bases. I said it was a crappy job. Those artillery people had a really.
Well, yeah. They got coordinates from, if they could read the coordinates from people like us who were, say, well, this looks like a good one.
Yeah, and it, you know, you they didn't want me to write about the doubt that I had about the information that
No.
that they wanted 6-digit coordinates. Thank you.
No. No, all the stuff I do, I didn't, I says, I didn't beat these people up. I talked to them, I says, ask some questions. They gave me questions. I wrote it down and I wrote a report and handed it in. I didn't,
Yeah.
I says, this is what I heard. Here it is. You can do what the fuck you want with it.
Yeah, but our stuff wasn't, the URIs. I think that's what, the radio intercepts. Those are the things that were most dependable. This kind of, at least, the human intelligence that I was getting from these low-level people, was pretty
Well,
much
yeah,
worthless.
until you go out there with a squad and trying to find them, and they're gone someplace else.
Yeah, right.
Well, I got this. I've got sort of a time thing here. I'm going to have
I think
to.
you probably finished it.
So,
Went through the time.
anyway, I'll just close it down, and then we can talk after. So, this is Mike Diedrich with Joe Gander, and talking about 96C, 96 Charlie, Vietnam interrogation and military intelligence, and broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. So thank you.
Thank you.